Hello and welcome to Switch Your Money On from Hargreaves Lansdowne. I'm Susanna Streeter, I'm Head of Money and Markets.
And I'm Sarah Coles, Head of Personal Finance.
And it is a wonder that we're both in the studio at the moment with a wave of coughs and colds doing the rounds. It's been weeks since everyone in my house has been well at the same time.
Yes, and our health more generally has been increasingly up for debate in the office as we've been discussing the effects of ill health on people's ability to work and the implications this has for everything from our financial resilience to our pensions.
Absolutely. Our health affects everything. Every area of our lives. But it also has an impact on companies, of course, in the health space. So 4 years on from the first UK lockdown, we thought it would be an interesting time to look at the pharmaceutical sector in an episode we're calling In Sickness and in Wealth.
So we'll look at how some of the biggest listed names are faring with Sophie Lund-Yates, our lead equity analyst. We'll also talk to Tim Tyson from Turex, a development and manufacturing organisation for the pharmaceutical industry in the US, who has an excellent overview of the industry both here and globally. So Tim, this is a really interesting time for the industry, isn't it?
Yes, it is an interesting time. A lot of things happening on a geopolitical basis.
We're going to dig into that a little bit later, Tim. Really great to have you on the podcast. We'll also be talking to Emma Wall, our Head of Investment Analysis and Research for a Fund Manager Perspective. But first of all, it does make sense to take stock of where the pharmaceutical industry is after a whirlwind few years.
Yes, and it is worth highlighting this is a massive industry for the UK, employing 66,000 people in over 600 businesses and with a turnover of 40.8 billion pounds. It also adds 14 billion of value to the UK. So, as Susanna said, we're now 4 years on since the UK went into its first COVID lockdown, when pharmaceuticals really came into the spotlight. So Pfizer launched the first vaccine, followed by others, including AstraZeneca. It was the fastest ever launch of a vaccine.
Yes, AstraZeneca produced a drug that was cost-effective and simple to distribute, while Pfizer's was expensive and needed sub-zero temperatures from lab to jab. Meanwhile, GSK's efforts petered out, producing little but disappointing trial outcomes until it was too late to really matter. The pandemic was somewhat of a minefield for the sector. Many were able to book substantial revenues from selling vaccines. However, the margins on those revenues could be low. AstraZeneca promised to deliver the drug at cost during the pandemic, and they soon subsided. There was also significant challenges posed by the pandemic itself, including supply chain issues.
In the short term, addressing the pandemic absorbed the sector to such an extent that research and development slowed in other areas, while more focus was put on respiratory diseases, infectious diseases, and vaccines. However, this did prove short-lived, and away from the pandemic, other developments in both medicine and society have been key for the sector since.
Yes, structural developments have meant demand for treatments remains high. Cancer in the UK continues to rise, with breast, prostate and colorectal cancers accounting for more than 50% of all cancers. There have been significant developments in oncology, with new treatments for breast, lung and gastric cancers.
And of course, the population's aging too, so more people are living longer when they tend to develop more conditions which need to be treated. But interestingly, that's actually only part of the picture, because more of us are living with health problems for longer, because we're actually getting sick earlier in life and healthy life expectancy is falling.
Now, part of this is due to lifestyle factors. This lies behind the fact that diagnoses of diabetes more than doubled over the past 15 years, and the number of morbidly obese people in the UK with a BMI of over 40 is forecast to double by 2035, which creates any number of health problems, but also a huge market for a solution. One of the most significant developments for the industry has been in diabetes and weight management medicine. New classes of drugs called GLP-1 and SGLT-2.
Yes, it's quite a mouthful. So clinical demand for GLP-1 is intensifying as diabetes becomes more common. Commercial demand for SGLT-2 is red hot too. So Novo Nordisk of Denmark and Pfizer are leading the charge at the moment, with others trying to edge in. Developing a new drug from scratch can take a decade or more, so there's likely to be a scramble from the big pharmaceutical companies to buy smaller rivals with promising GLP-1 candidates under development as they try to catch up.
However, there are also headwinds for the sector to navigate, and costs are among the trickiest. Inflation, interest rates, tax regimes in some parts of the world, and an environment of increasing threats is raising the cost of doing business. Now, the biggest market in the world for drugs is the US. And here, the Inflation Reduction Act will allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices for the first time, which could make a significant difference to price in each therapeutic area. There's also major competition, as more scientific development means more treatments available and companies going head-to-head for sales. R&D spending is most focused on blood treatments, followed by cancer, infections, musculoskeletal problems, and immunology.
So there are clearly competitive challenges as well as opportunities. So this feels like a good time to bring in Sophie Lund-Yates, our lead equity analyst, who's been looking into some of the biggest listed names in pharma. So Sophie, having said all that, we can't really avoid talking about Novo Nordisk. What can you tell us?
Hi, you are absolutely right. So Novo Nordisk is, of course, the Danish pharmaceutical giant that has set the world and the stock market alight in recent times, thanks to its weight loss treatments, including Wegovy. Now, Novo has long been in this sort of arena. It specialised in diabetes care like insulin before these therapies went what can only be described as viral. Now, Wegovy saw a fourfold increase in sales last year. Now, there's also talk of oral weight loss therapies rather than the current form, which is injectable. Now, not only could these be more effective, they're also potentially more accessible because they're more palatable. So while the growth drivers for Novo definitely centre around these weight loss treatments, new drugs are in an experimental phase, which increases risk as there's no guarantee they'll come to market. I mean, it's also worth bearing in mind that there is a risk of a backlash. So the longer term or adverse effects from the likes of Wegovy are not well understood. Now, some concerns are starting to come to light and this will need monitoring. So to put some of this into perspective, Novo Nordisk has operating margins in the region of 40%, which means there's room to suffer some ups and downs. The group's price to earnings ratio, which shows how much the market is prepared to pay for future profits, has risen to over 35 compared to 23.7 over the last 10 years. That is a show of confidence from the market, reflecting the group's enviable market position and attractive end markets. But as ever, a higher valuation also increases the risks of ups and downs, because when hopes are high, disappointment is felt more acutely.
Okay, thanks very much, Sophie. What else have you been looking at?
So that would be GSK or GlaxoSmithKline. Now, first and foremost, what listeners should be reminded of is the fact that following the demerger of its consumer health division, Haleon, GSK is now a pure play pharmaceutical developer. This means the research and development of new drugs is the group's focus, and we've been impressed with progress. And one area that caught our attention is that the group had four major product approvals last year. Pharmaceutical companies are nothing without approvals, for obvious reasons. And the risk comes in because getting drugs to market is a very expensive undertaking. And a bit like I was discussing with Novo, there's never a guarantee, you know, that the approvals will come in any given period. And that's why it's important to focus on companies that have proven track records in research and development, because as much as nothing's guaranteed, it's important to start by looking at those with stronger foundations. Now, some areas that GSK specialises in are shingles treatments and HIV. Now, HIV drugs make up about 20% of the group's £30 billion of annual revenue. Now, looking further out, cancer drugs are seen as a growth area. And there has, unsurprisingly, been a reduction in COVID-19 related sales, but the worst of the effect of this on results looks to have washed through the system. A big driver of sentiment, really, and therefore valuation in the short term, will be the outcome of court hearings relating to the concerns about cancer links to heartburn drug Zantac. Concerns about this are reflected in the lower valuation compared to the average, and the team continues to have conviction in the company, but there are heightened risks of ups and downs, which shouldn't be ignored.
Thanks, Sophie. What's the final name this week?
So the final name this week is AstraZeneca, which is, of course, another UK-listed pharmaceutical giant. Now, Astra was hit hard because, as many listeners will know, it was at the forefront of COVID-19 vaccinations. And when the tide turned, so too did the group's sales. Now, that said, Astra has done a stellar job of offsetting this, and we're especially supportive of the group's position in speciality medicines and treatments for rare diseases. Now, while coming up with treatments for these can be more technically challenging, it makes the eventual products that much more attractive. So the group's bigger push into product development is likely to have an effect on profitability for now, which serves as a reminder to consider investing, especially in individual stocks, on a longer term view. We like Astra's specialised approach because it could spell better margins in the future, but these novel therapies don't appear overnight. And with that in mind, investors should continue to assess the balance sheet, and Astra's is in reasonable shape. I mean, we'll be keeping an eye on it, though, as the group looks to spend more on research and development.
So clearly an awful lot of change, Sophie, to keep an eye on in the pharmaceutical industry at the moment. So with that in mind, this is a great time to bring back in Tim Tyson, who's still with us. So Tim, there's an awful lot to cover here, but let's start with kind of gaining an insight into your perspective. Can you tell us about TRIX and just how it gives you an overview of the industry?
TRIX is a global contract development and manufacturing organization that serves the global pharmaceutical industry. The most pressing challenges are access to innovative medicines that can treat some of the difficult conditions that you've been talking about, and getting them to the people when and where they need them.
How does your company provide a part of that jigsaw?
We're involved in the development and manufacture of medicine, so we develop and make and deliver products around the world. We're involved in both human health and animal disease. We make all types of medicines, liquids, creams, ointments, injectables, and oral dosage form medicines.
So given you've got this sort of global overview of different companies operating really everywhere, how do you say the UK pharmaceutical companies stack up?
The UK has always been a source of innovative medicines, as well as talent and facilities and capabilities. A strong piece of the international global pharmaceutical supply chain.
What do pharmaceutical companies need to do to grow here? What are the challenges that they face?
The challenges, like all markets, are facilities, capabilities, talent, and the ability to have support from the government to ensure that it's not overly taxed and incentivized to make investments.
And how does the UK stack up compared to other governments around the world on that criteria? Would you say that a lot more needs to be done? Could you point to any kind of innovative projects that have helped boost the potential for growth?
The UK is, I would say, around the world, an average country to do business in. Some of the most recent things that have happened are some grants to support inward investment and to encourage employment in the United Kingdom, and very strong support and government to industry relationships.
So you mentioned talent a couple of times. So is there a sort of global shortage of the talent that these companies need in order to grow?
Yeah, the pandemic created a lot of problems and challenges from people and availability of resources. And highly competent, skilled, motivated talent is key in our industry.
What's the best way of producing such talent and ensuring that companies are able to access this talent easily?
I think in our space, where we're looking for scientific and medical technicals from both a science and engineering background, it's important to have a relationship with the universities and to encourage a university and industry relationship to ensure we get the right type of skills and talent.
Tell me a little bit about your site in Speak in Liverpool, in the northwest of England. How has that tied in to marrying both academia and industry?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it was founded back in the war to produce innovative antibiotics to solve some of the infectious disease. It was a result of the types of wounds and things that occurred during the war. Right now, to continue going from where it started as producing life-saving medicines for infectious disease, it's now producing medicines for all types of disease. And we have a strong relationship with the universities in that area, both in Liverpool, Manchester, and in Durham, as well as at Oxford and Cambridge.
What would you say the most interesting developments are right now in the industry? Is it kind of immunotherapy drugs, for example?
The immunotherapy drugs, a lot of them in the monoclonal antibodies, are critical to the continued solution of difficulties that humans and animals suffer from. And we have a strong focus on monoclonal antibodies and actually have a partnership with the UK government to build a very strong capability in the production of monoclonal antibodies at our site in Speke.
In terms of the industry, do you think there's any risk about the sort of concentration of research? The weight management drugs are obviously kind of on the top of everybody's list at the moment. Do you think there's a real risk that the focus kind of goes onto those and then comes away from some of these other areas? Or do you think there's a decent balance even when you get a particularly hot type of drug?
Yeah, I think there's a balance in the industry, always has been and always will be. The industry migrates to areas where there's opportunity. There's both scientific problem-solving opportunities as well as economic and commercial advantages. And so it's the long-term, short-term, and I think there is a balance and a concern for helping to solve some of the problems that humans and animals face with a focus on developing a broad spectrum of medicines for treating those conditions and diseases.
And how excited are you about the prospects for AI in the pharmaceutical industry, and particularly your business?
Yeah, it's an uncharted area with huge opportunity. Mining data has always been the future of innovation in our industry, and being able to mine data and to put together algorithms that can accelerate the ability to do that is absolutely essential.
So lots of opportunities, but what would you say, Tim, is the biggest challenge you're facing at the moment, and how are you approaching it?
I think the biggest challenge is cost of medicine on a global basis. It is a major pressure. And so balancing the cost of research and development and bringing medicines to the marketplace and having the appropriate governments and people to pay for those medicines is a challenge. And balancing those is critical, and doing things in a fair, cost-effective and in a reasonable basis is critical for everybody.
Okay, Tim. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It certainly seems like the interesting times for the sector are far from over. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to see both of you.
And with that in mind, let's bring in Emma Wall, our Head of Investment Analysis and Research, who's been discussing the sector in detail with John Baylor of BNY Mellon.
Hi, John.
Hello, Emma.
So we're here today to talk about pharmaceuticals. I thought we'd go back to basics. What is it about the pharmaceutical sector that appeals to you as an investor?
Yeah, so as a U.S. equity income investor, we like the pharmaceutical sector because it provides a couple of characteristics that we look for in portfolios. One of them being good downside protection because they have limited economic sensitivity. They also provide very good dividend yields, at least the pharma stocks do within the healthcare space. We also think they've got earnings trajectories that right now look to be, in some cases, in really good shape in terms of, you know, being able to grow earnings on a secular basis as people get older and we use more drugs.
And of course, nothing is guaranteed with investing. But pharmaceutical firms, there is a bit of forecasting you can do with revenues, isn't there? Because of the nature of the drugs and the way that patents work.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So one of the things that we think we do well in the pharmaceutical space is we find opportunities where there's, you know, a lot of skepticism in the future pipeline of the drugs. And we look for, you know, those companies where there's skepticism, the stocks are trading at, you know, very cheap levels of free cash flow, so high free cash flow yields, the cheap on how much cash flow they're generating. And then we try to get a differentiated opinion on those pipelines. In a lot of cases, we're buying a lot of that skepticism, but, you know, we've done our fundamental work and we believe that they're going to do much better on their pipeline drugs than the market believes. And that has historically been where we've found the most opportunities in the space.
Let's talk a little bit then about the risks. In the past, this has been a bit of a political football. I mean, we're going back to sort of Hillary Clinton era here. Because the pharmaceutical sector, much like tech at the moment as well, attracts some political conversation around regulation. Is that something that you are thinking about when you're analyzing these companies?
So absolutely. The political environment is very important, especially for the pharma stocks here in the United States. What we believe is, at least going into this presidential election, the Republican and Democratic parties are actually more alike than there are different. President Trump and President Biden are very populist. So, you know, we do think there is a little bit of risk in terms of, you know, drug price negotiation. Now, that being said, We did have the IRA Act pass, and one of the ways we paid for the IRA Act is price negotiation on Medicare drugs. And so we know what drugs are on that list currently, and we have really avoided those businesses that have drugs and a decent amount of Medicare exposure in our portfolio. Going forward, you know, the likelihood of a divided government, I think, is very high. So our belief is there really isn't going to be much that gets done in a divided government. And because we've already passed the IRA Act, there probably isn't anything big incrementally that's going to happen on drug price negotiation. It's just going to be, you know, small tweaks to the legislation.
Let's then talk a bit about the opportunities. It has very much been headline grabbing in the last 12 to 18 months. The weight loss sector, Ozempic and its peers, particularly around kind of the next generation. Where do you see this trend going? And is there much of that already priced in?
Yes. So we were very bullish a few years ago on the weight loss drugs, the GLP-1 drugs. We owned, you know, the biggest beneficiary of the weight loss drugs in the U.S. here. And we owned it because we had a very differentiated view of the weight loss market and also the Alzheimer's market for this individual company. We thought it was going to be much better than expected. And it really played out the way our analysts saw it playing out. And, you know, he thought that you could get to $90 billion in terms of a market opportunity for weight loss drugs, which was larger than what a lot of people were expecting a few years ago. But at this point, and we moved on from that stock last year in 2023, because we think the market is pricing in that full benefit of the GLP-1 drugs. You know, the way we look at it is through discounted cash flow models. We think these companies are pricing in a 4% perpetual growth rate after you get to that $90 billion market. And we just think that's too high because, you know, once you have developed this drug, once you're selling it on a normalized basis, there's obviously going to be competition. Potentially, there's going to be generics of the drugs. Historically, for pharma companies, you do not pay more than a 2% perpetual growth rate on your discounted cash flow model once you get to kind of that normalized cash flow levels. So we just think you're paying too much for these companies. So we don't have any exposure there right now.
And then what about what's currently in the portfolio? Either any particular companies or subsectors or trends that you think are exciting you right now?
We're actually taking the opposite view. We think there are companies that the perception is they're going to get hurt by GLP-1 drugs. So we own a number of companies that are medical device companies for cardiovascular surgeries. We also own a company that actually benefits because they make the syringes for the GLP-1 drugs. So we really think that's where the opportunity is in the market. A lot of those companies got hurt by the pandemic. There was less procedures during the pandemic, and we see utilization really moving up right now in terms of surgeries and elective surgeries. Hospitals are starting to do well, and a lot of these medical device companies are starting to do well. So that's really where we're seeing the best opportunities in the healthcare space.
John, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot, Emma.
That was Emma Wall talking to John Baylor of BNY Mellon. And please bear in mind that these are the views of the fund manager and are not individual stock recommendations.
You're listening to Switch Your Money On from Hargreaves Lansdown. And before we go, there is time, of course, quick drum roll, for the stat of the week. And as we mentioned earlier, healthy life expectancy is falling. But the question is, at what age are we likely to stop leading a healthy life and develop one or more conditions? And because this is reported separately for different nations of the UK, we'll just take England for the sake of simplicity. And that's because we're in England right now. So, Sarah, I know you've looked into this because actually we were talking about how it's lower than the state pension age, which gives you quite a decent clue. But can you remember the age where men and women are likely to fall into ill health?
Now you're asking. I mean, I know I've already reached the age where I make a lot more fuss about getting up in the morning. So I know already the deterioration has set in. I do know that it's in our sort of early 60s that we start to suffer from ill health. I just can't remember when. So I'll go down the middle. I'll say 63.
You're very close. So at birth in 2022 for men, it was just under 62 and a half. And for women, it was just over 62 and a half. So you're slightly too optimistic.
I am. Although it hasn't stopped me funding my pension just in case. In financial planning terms, I'm definitely a sort of belt and braces and then another belt for good measure kind of a planner.
Which, if nothing else, is a very interesting fashion choice. Well, that's all from us for this time. But before we go, we do need to remind you that this was recorded on the 15th of April, 2024, and all information was correct at the time of recording.
Nothing in this podcast is personal advice. You should seek advice if you're not sure what's right for you. Investments rise and fall in value, so you could get back less than you invest, and past performance is not a guide to the future.
Yes, this is not advice or a recommendation to buy, sell or hold any investment. No view is given on the present or future value or price of any investment, and investors should form their own view on any proposed investment.
And this hasn't been prepared in accordance with legal requirements designed to promote the independence of investment research and is considered a marketing communication.
Non-independent research is not subject to FCA rules prohibiting dealing ahead of research. However, HL has put controls in place, including dealing restrictions, physical and information barriers, to manage potential conflicts of interest presented by such dealing.
You can see our full non-independent research disclosure on our website for more information. So all that's left is for us to thank our guests, Tim, John, Sophie, Emma, and our producer, Elizabeth Hodson.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again soon. Goodbye.